Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 135 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for September the 18th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our three-month-long discussion of Antony and Cleopatra. We'll look back at the history behind the play, some of its production challenges, and a quick look ahead. Okay, so here are the historical facts and figures and how they are manipulated into the fiction of Shakespeare's dramatic world. But we're going to have to go back over 40 years before the start of our play. 83 BCE. Mark Antony is born, Rome, Italy. 69 BCE. Cleopatra is born in Alexandria, Egypt, to the ruling Ptolemaic line. As with all the Ptolemies, Cleopatra is Greek, not Egyptian, as the original Ptolemy was a Macedonian general under Alexander the Great. She was Cleopatra VII. Her father was the previous leader of Egypt, Ptolemy XII. Her mother, it is thought, was Cleopatra V, her father's wife, who is also his sister, as was the tradition of the Ptolemaic line. 60 BCE, the first triumvirate is formed with Crassus, Julius Caesar, and Pompey the Great. 57 BCE, Mark Antony continues military service, now under the command of the proconsul of Syria. During his time in the region, in 55 BCE, Antony supposedly encounters a 14-year-old Cleopatra, and according to some accounts, he is smitten even then. 53 BCE, with the death of Crassus, as well as Pompey's wife, who happened to be Caesar's daughter, the first triumvirate is no more. Caesar, now with Antony as part of his command, goes off to conquer Gaul, while Pompey is elected solo consul of Rome. 51 BCE, Ptolemy XII dies, leaving his 18-year-old daughter, Cleopatra VII, and her 10-year-old brother as joint rulers. As is the custom, Cleopatra marries her brother, Ptolemy XIII, but she does not intend to rule with him. In fact, she removes him from official documents, coins, and the like. 49 BCE. Roman civil war begins between forces behind Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar. Just for your information, Lepidus and Antony were under Caesar's command, and Cassius and Brutus were under Pompey's command. 48 BCE. Ptolemy XIII drives Cleopatra from Egypt into Syria, and the Egyptian civil war begins. In the Roman civil war, Caesar's forces defeat Pompey's at Pharsalus. Pompey flees to Egypt. Brutus joins Caesar, is pardoned, forgiven, and allowed into Caesar's inner circle. Cassius is captured, pardoned, and he fights for Caesar. Ptolemy, trying to curry favor with Caesar, has Pompey killed and beheaded. When Caesar arrives, Ptolemy presents him with Pompey's head. Caesar is not amused. Caesar instead invades and captures Alexandria and makes himself the arbiter in the Egyptian civil war between Ptolemy and Cleopatra. Cleopatra, in an attempt to politically outflank her brother, has a carpet sent as a gift to Caesar, with her naked, wrapped within it. Allegedly. She becomes his mistress. She is now 21. Caesar is 52. But it seems that he's still pretty virile, as 9 months later, in 47 BCE, Cleopatra gives birth to Caesar's son, whom they name Caesarion. Cleopatra wants Caesarion named as Caesar's heir, as this is Caesar's only son, but he chooses his grandnephew Octavian instead. Caesar does, however, defeat Ptolemy's forces. Ptolemy XIII is killed at the Battle of the Nile and installs Cleopatra as queen of Egypt. But he also grants her other brother, let's call him Ptolemy XIV, because that's what they did, co-ruler status. Ptolemy XIV and Cleopatra marry, though she remains Caesar's lover. Caesar leaves to chase down and mop up the remnants of Pompey's army, and meanwhile in Rome, Fulvia delivers a son by Mark Antony, also called Mark Antony. 46 BCE. Ptolemy, Cleopatra, and Caesarion visit Rome, where they stay at one of Caesar's estates. Mistresses were accepted, but the fact that she is a foreign head of state was still pretty scandalous. 45 BCE. Caesar takes the war to Spain and defeats the last of Pompey's relatives and returns to Rome, and the events of Julius Caesar the play begin. 44 BCE, Caesar has a really bad month of March and gets stabbed in the back. The mob runs the conspirators out of Rome, and 2 months later, Octavian arrives. Meanwhile, the Egyptian contingent heads back home. Funny thing, though, Ptolemy doesn't survive the trip. He dies. Poisoned, allegedly, by his sister Cleopatra. Allegedly. But let's face facts. If this is true, she only did to him what he was going to do to her at some point. Allegedly. 43 BCE. Antony, Octavian, and Lepidus form the second triumvirate. Antony is 40, Octavian 20, Lepidus is 45. 42 BCE. The two battles of Philippi take place. Cassius and Brutus die, separated by 3 weeks. The events of Julius Caesar end. Antony takes control of the eastern portion of Caesar's empire. 41 BCE. As part of Antony's eastern campaigns, he calls for Cleopatra to meet him at Tarsus. She arrives on a barge that Eno Barbus will describe in Antony and Cleopatra. Antony follows Cleopatra to Alexandria, where she becomes his mistress. Or to hear his soldiers tell it, he becomes her boy toy. While Antony is away, his brother Lucius and wife Fulvia begin a war against Octavian, who has been starting a power and land grab in Italy. 40 BCE. Octavian defeats Lucius and Fulvia. Fulvia dies from an illness. And the events of the play, Antony and Cleopatra, begin. Antony heads back to Rome to reconcile with Octavian, and to do so, he marries Octavia. While he is with Octavia in Athens, Cleopatra gives birth to twins Alexander and Cleopatra, fathered by Antony, and mentioned only in hindsight by Shakespeare. 39 BCE. The triumvirate comes to terms with Sextus Pompeius, the son of Pompey the Great. 38 BCE. Octavian renews the war with Pompey. 37 BCE. After 2 years in Athens with Octavia, during which she bears him 2 daughters, which is totally skipped by Shakespeare, Antony returns to the Parthian campaign, which is mentioned by Shakespeare, and reunites with Cleopatra. This reunion is skipped by Shakespeare. 36 BCE. Octavian, with assistance from Lepidus, defeats Pompey, who flees, just like dear old dad. Octavian then has Lepidus arrested for plotting a usurpation and exiles him. Antony returns to Alexandria with Cleopatra and marries her. The actual event is skipped by Shakespeare, but we hear about it. Cleopatra bears Antony another son, Philadelphus, skipped. Octavia returns to Rome, mentioned, but much earlier in the sequence. 35 BCE. Octavian tracks down, captures, and executes Pompey. 34 BCE. Antony divorces Octavia, skipped by Shakespeare, then divides his portion of the empire in Egypt between his children. 33 BCE. Through military conquest, Octavian takes back much of the land in Antony's portion of the empire. 32 BCE. Rome declares war on Cleopatra, skipped. 31 BCE. Octavian defeats Antony and Cleopatra at the Battle of Actium in Greece. 30 BCE. Octavian invades Egypt. Antony and Cleopatra commit suicide. The events of Antony and Cleopatra end 10 years after the first events of the play. During the mop-up, Octavian captures, then executes Mark Antony, the 17-year-old son of Antony, just to tie up loose ends. 27 BCE. 3 years after the events of our play, Octavian is declared the first emperor of Rome, and he changes his name to Augustus. So, like I just mentioned, the play Antony and Cleopatra, like Julius Caesar before it, plays with time. The events of the play's opening take place in 40 BCE with Fulvia's death, and they end in 30 BCE with the deaths of our titular characters. That's 10 years passing from beginning to the end of the play. So the question must be asked, as a director, do you try to show the passage of time, and if so, how? Or do you just ignore it? Does the concept of time play a big enough role in the narrative, as it does in, say, Romeo and Juliet, to merit the focus? Or rather, do you make the pacing of the play the key, driving the narrative forward quickly, showing a lack of time for our characters to make better decisions? As I like history, I lean towards having the passage of time play some kind of role in the presentation, and I think it's supported in the text as well. There are 5 references to Antony's relative age. 4 are in the second half of the play, after Act 3, Scene 7, where we jump ahead 5 years in actual history. Cleopatra's 8 references are split evenly between the 2 halves. youthful Octavian's seven references are mostly in the back half, 5 verses 2. And of the six general mentions of age and youth, the second half references outnumber the first half 2 to 1. If time and age are more on the minds of the characters in the second half of the play, of Antony's 13 spoken references, 11 are in the second half, and all of Octavian's 3 spoken references are there as well, it would make sense that time is passing. Because I have reached a certain age, I know that time and age are more pressing matters to me now than they were when I was in my salad days. Which takes us back to the subordinate question in our first query. How do we make such a presentation? Do you present the dates on stage somehow? Do you age the characters? Now, this is dangerous, though. Makeup is one thing that should not call attention to itself. And while we're on the subject of directorial conundrums, what about that strange opening stage direction for Act 3, Scene 10? Canidius marcheth with his land army one way over the stage, and Taurus, the lieutenant of Caesar, the other way. After their going in is heard the noise of a sea fight. So, how do you stage that? Okay, so you march Canidius and his land army, what, half a dozen guys in Roman tunics, across the stage, and then you march Taurus solo across the stage in the other direction, and then you pipe in sounds of a sea fight? And just what distinguishes the noise of a sea fight from that of a good old land battle? That sounds like a setup for the lamest drama geek joke of all time. Would the punchline be the lack of horsey neighs? Staging this play must give directors and designers fits and nightmares. I mean, the play's got 43 scenes in it. That's more than twice the average play's 21. Histories and tragedies average just over 24, but that's still 19 short. There are times when this feels very screenplay-like, with its short scenes and huge location jumps. Except for one thing. Well, I'll make that two. The Enobarbus description of the barge and Octavian's recollection of news from Alexandria. In a screenplay or film, you'd just shoot it. Maybe you'd run the speech as a voiceover, but maybe you don't, in the same way that Kurzel stripped Macbeth down to the dialogue bone. But on stage? And while we're at it, what about that hella long gap in the play between Antony and Cleopatra's second and third appearances together in the play? 1,249 lines, comprising 41% of the length of the play itself, which is more than 2 times the line count for the portion they are together in the entirety of the play. And that gap spans from Act 1, Scene 4 to Act 3, Scene 7, a total of 15 scenes, and probably the intermission to boot, as the midpoint of the play occurs in the scene immediately before that one. So what to do? I mean, our title lovers appear together in 2 of the first 3 scenes of the play, and then, just as we're settling down and getting used to seeing them as a couple dominate the stage, poof, nothing. Nada, zero, zip, zilch for the remainder of the first half of the play until folks get a chance for a potty break and to buy some refreshments. That's a long time not to see the characters for whom the play is named, a title with the word and in it, which kinda implies their coupleness. So what to do? Or do we even need to be concerned about this at all? Audience expectations be damned. Questions, but no easy answers. So yeah, fits and nightmares for directors and designers. Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who were asking for bigger, poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website. A couple of weeks back, I tweeted out to the 4 major presidential candidates. Yes, I included Libertarian Green Party nominees. And I asked them to name their favorite Shakespearean character and why, spurred on by an article in the UK newspaper The Guardian, citing U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's statement that his fave was Rosalind from As You Like It. Alas, no responses yet. Of course, these are busy people, and I really wasn't expecting any. Well, now it's your turn. Author and frequent commentator on this blog, Gene Heglin, posted a great idea, one that opens up the idea to you, O readers of the blog and listeners of the podcast. She wrote, "In the meantime, can we post our guesses on their faves? Though I suppose this could actually be two games, couldn't it? First, there's who we imagine the candidate's favorite character might be, and then there's who we think their favorite character should be, given how we interpret the candidate's background and personalities." I love the first half of that suggestion. Note, I do like the second part too, but I fear that there may be some, let us say, emotional leakage that might end up in flame wars, hurt feelings, and tears. But heck, as we get closer to election day, I may just go there anyway. So, here's your assignment, my imaginative, intrepid interpreters. Pick a candidate. Suggest a character that you think the candidate would favor, and a quick note why. Attach it to the comment thread for this podcast's blog entry. Or if you're shy, you can email them to me at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com, and I may just read them in a future podcast. Heck, I might just get in on the fun too. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular podcast, and that was a long time ago, you've missed out on subjects including, and just how are we supposed to do that? Timon of Athens, OSF trailer. Subconscious decoupling anyone? Solving problems, asking questions. Antony and Cleopatra video capsule review, 2014 Stratford Festival. When Dickie met Cleo. Why, Miss Cleo, what a history you have. Cleo's history. Tabletop Shakespeare streaming this week. Alas, poor Lepidus. Antony and Cleopatra video capsule review, 1981 BBC. Octavian, Last Man Standing. Watered Down Antony. Happy Labor Day and Meet the Bard Dog. A Question of Presidential Politics. Time Flies. Antony and Cleopatra video capsule review, 1984 Bard Productions. Your Question of Presidential Politics. Bloody Sunday Bloody, A Tale of Two Shakespeares. So, Eno Barbus. Smoke, well, perfume on the water. Antony and Cleopatra video capsule review, 1974 RSC. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. But remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for September the 18th, 2016. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.